In the past, literacy was the ability to read, write, and do arithmetic. However, as the world became more complex, so did the skills necessary to navigate that world. So what principles make education most effective? Does it all have to take place in the classroom? And does the intensity of schooling make a difference? Stand by, Go Healthy for Good starts right now. Hello and welcome to Go Healthy for Good. Learning begins at birth and continues through every stage of our lives. Whether in formal education or by experience, learning should never stop. So meet Barbara. She learned a lot by attending a three-week program at Eden Valley Lifestyle Centre.
My mom and my dad, our whole family, is more on the larger side. And I just seemed to just gain weight, and I became what they call obese in 1998. I was diagnosed with diabetes and put on pills. I also developed heart problems. I'm on high blood pressure pills. I also have depression, and I'm on pills for that. I have rheumatoid arthritis, and I can't remember all the diagnoses, but I was on lots of medicine. I thought I just would end up having a stroke or a heart attack and I would die. I did not feel good. I did not have energy. I had to sit all the time. The farthest I could walk was probably about 50 feet without being real extremely short of breath. Going upstairs or downstairs was very difficult. I had both my knees replaced in 2014, and I did pretty good for a while, but then my weight was at 306 pounds, and at one point in time it was 315. And I went to the doctor and I realized that I had to do something. I had gone through a lifestyle center once before, and I knew lots of the health principles, and I started trying to practice them, but my ability to walk was very limited, and I loved to cook, and so I was loving to eat. My sister ended up choosing that she would be willing to send me to Eden Valley, and I went there, and at first I could hardly walk, but they have a program for walking. The buildings are quite a distance apart. And I once told Travis, I said, when you asked if I could walk around the block, I thought you meant around a block like my size in Berrien Springs. But I'm realizing you're talking more like city blocks because they are much bigger. And he just kind of laughed with me and enjoyed it.
We'll hear the rest of Barbara's journey to wellness, create a superfood salad, and explore the impact of digital devices. And today's guest shares educational wisdom for our young people. So let's get started with the news. In the headlines today, pets good for allergies, milk linked to acne, and if you smoke, eat healthy. Being born into a household with pets may protect from developing allergies and obesity. Researchers from the University of Alberta, Canada, analyzed 700 children and found babies exposed to pets while in the womb or up to 3 months of age had twice as much ruminococcus and acillospira than kids without pet exposure. Having higher levels of these two types of microbes as an infant is associated with lower rates of allergies and obesity later in life. Infants can either get the bacteria directly from the animals or from their mothers passing it from the pet to the baby. The lead researcher suggested that perhaps the pharmaceutical industry might create a dog and a pill to help kids who don't have the health advantage of growing up with a pet in the house. Though a dog in the house is so much more fun than a pill. The controversy over whether milk causes acne continues to simmer as another study lends support. Over the last decade, several large studies have shown an association between dairy consumption, especially skim milk, and acne in teens. A team of researchers from Penn State University, Pennsylvania, asked about 100 teenagers who had moderately severe acne and another 100 without what they had eaten in the past 24 hours. They repeated the questionnaire on three occasions and found that consuming non-fat dairy increased the risk of acne. While there's currently no clear explanation, it is a fairly simple switch to a calcium-fortified alternative. Smokers and ex-smokers who eat lots of fruit and veggies appear to have some protection from chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, or COPD. COPD includes lung problems like emphysema, chronic bronchitis, bronchiectasis, and asthma, which are commonly associated with smoking. 44,000 Swedish men were followed for 13 years, and those eating more than 5 servings of fruit and veggies a day had a 40% lower risk of COPD than those eating less than 2 servings. This finding's in line with previous studies that show lung function improves after more fruit and veggies are consumed. In the Swedish study, fruit seemed to be more protective than veggies. So if you have or are at risk of COPD, be sure to get at least 5 servings of fruit and veggies a day. Though if you smoke, why not quit? I'm Dr. Narada McKibben, and that's today's health news. Today's guest is the Vice President of Academic Affairs at Weimar Institute in California, where we conducted this interview. Weimar offers college courses in nursing, health sciences, religion, and general education. Some people say that the higher education system in the US is broken. I asked Dr. Davis what he says to that.
One of the things that the literature plays out, when you look at it, the higher education system is suffering from problems that are happening in the primary and the secondary schools. And what they're seeing now is that students are being, for lack of a better term, they're getting addicted to various types of media. For example, they're always on a device, whether it's a laptop, whether it's an iPhone or a tablet of some type. So there's oversaturation of the media. There are other issues that are impacting the higher education system, namely that it is an old-moded system. And one of the allegories that's used in terms of the language is that you take a look at the old battleship, Old Ironsides. It's a beautiful ship. But the problem is it's outlived its usefulness. It doesn't work in today's modern theater. And so that's a lot of the issues that are plaguing higher education as well, is that we've got old paradigms trying to fit into this 21st century model that is ever changing. There's a high demand for public resources. They're just not there. They've also found that there's a growing demand for vocational education. In other words, for a lot of the students to have more of a trade-based type of training as opposed to simply academic type training. In particular, in the United States, 40% of those who are going to college and earn a degree, they're going to have a difficult time finding a job.
Is this shift to vocational training new, or are we just overdoing the academic education?
You know, in a lot of ways, this is not a new thing. Okay. For example, Germany's been doing this for decades. Over half of their students that finish up the ninth grade and they begin to seek whichever track they're going to go on, over half of them learn a trade. And as a result, they become productive members of society. And it's no wonder that you see Germany as a country of producers, not consumers. They're always number one, number two in terms of the world's leading exporter. And no wonder. Academics are important for them, but they also understand that a country needs to run with tradesmen, carpenters, plumbers, electricians, chefs, and so forth.
I think we all agree we need skilled tradespeople. However, Americans would be dissatisfied often if their kids wanted to learn a trade. Now it's time to think about this.
Oh man, I hate raking leaves. It's such hard work.
Well, it's better for you than housework.
Well, what do you mean?
Yeah, yard work is better than going to the gym.
Oh really? How come?
Because the stale, sweaty air in the gym that other people have breathed in and out a few times, you get to breathe in.
Oh, yuck.
Yeah.
Well, I guess being outdoors, you get more sunshine on your skin, converts the cholesterol into vitamin D, which strengthens your immune system, helps your bones.
Yeah, there's something that you need to know, though.
And what is that?
Exercise does you more good if you have a good attitude about it.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm. Researchers have shown better attitude, longer life.
Yeah, and I also heard that women who have a positive attitude, they have less death, less diabetes, and less hypertension.
And less cancer, because a good attitude combats depression and boosts your immune system.
So would you mind if I do all this work, you just sit back, let me get the sunshine, the fresh air, and the hard work?
Well, it sounds a bit selfish, but I guess I'll just sit it out and watch you work while you get all the benefit. Come on, keep going. Doctor's orders. Salad time, and Phil has a salad with a difference. What have you got for us?
Well, it's quite different. This is our beet and blueberry salad. So we're going to have blueberries, beets, a little bit of a dressing. It's a great side salad for maybe someone that may not like beets. It's a different way of doing beets, and even just kind of to vary things up.
Yeah, because we always think green, don't we? So this is not green, obviously.
Absolutely.
Yeah. What's in it?
So this has 3 large beets, 1/3 cup of fresh lemon juice, 2 tablespoons of honey, 2 tablespoons of olive oil, 1 tablespoon of grated ginger, 4 cups of fresh blueberries, 1 cup of chopped walnuts, and 1/2 cup of chopped fresh mint.
Mmm.
So it's got all kinds of great stuff in there.
Wow, this is like a superfood salad.
Yes. So if you don't mind, you can start by putting the blueberries and the walnuts into our beets.
All right.
You can buy beets pre-cooked, and that's a great way to do this because you want them to be cooked.
Yep, we do. Or you can microwave them. Did you know microwaving saves more nutrients than other types of cooking? So that's a great way to do them, quick and easy. And
while you do that, I'm going to be putting these, our dressing together. Just want to combine everything. And then I am going to grate our ginger. You want to make sure that you get... I love fresh ground ginger. It's a great way to do it.
Oh, yeah.
And it's very easy in supermarkets these days to get fresh ginger. So all you need to do is just grind it up.
It is. Though you can even get ginger quite already done quite easily in a tube or in a jar. And that also tastes great. Though not as good as fresh, but almost.
You miss out on a little bit of the smell. But yeah. But I'm absolutely with you. They've made it very easy to get fresh ingredients these days.
Mm-hmm.
So there's really no excuse to having a great meal and great dishes.
Now these walnuts feel toasted. They're lovely and light and crunchy.
Absolutely. And it's a good idea. I like to toast them. I know if you need to go for a simpler path, you can get away with it. But to me, when you toast them, it brings out a little bit more flavor. Gives it a little bit of a different consistency. So I recommend that, and I'm just gonna whisk our dressing here.
Now beets, did you know beets are really effective at bringing down blood pressure?
I did not.
Mm.
That's a great thing to know.
Yep, and endurance athletes get better performance with beets or beet juice. So this is a dream, this salad. It's fantastic.
So
I'm going to try this on my husband.
For athletes, for adults of any age? And
yes, good for heart failure too. So adults, elderly adults who might be struggling with heart failure, they'll also do better with beets. So,
And I found that this is a great thing. When I was a kid, I didn't like beets. So I found when I got older that if you just kind of vary it up and try different recipes, you might find that it's not the vegetable you don't like, just maybe the way that it was cooked or presented.
Right.
And so this is a great way to kind of vary it up, especially if you have someone that doesn't really like beets or doesn't have enough experience with it. this is a great way to introduce them in a different way.
Right. And let me just get these for you.
So milk. I like to stir everything up first, get everything mixed up, and then I like to put the dressing in.
That way it goes evenly.
So yep. I'm waiting until everything's in there. Okay. And then I'm going to put in this dressing that we've whipped up.
That dressing looks pretty awesome. Wow. Sorry, I'm holding up the wagon.
No. This is a beautiful salad.
Yeah, looks fantastic.
And once you throw that in, it's just going to add even more depth of color. Oh, that smells good.
Oh, doesn't it? That mint. Oh, beautiful.
All right, so we'll put this in.
Mm-mm.
Give it a good stir. And this is our recipe.
That looks awesome. Woohoo!
And it's that simple.
Beautiful, beautiful. Oh, looks fantastic. Got to get a bit of everything here.
It's going to surprise you. It is a great salad.
That is incredible. You have got to try this. This blend of flavors is amazing. Thanks, Phil.
If you missed that recipe, then you'll find it on our website, hopetv.org/gohealthy. Barbara had too many health problems to enumerate, including diabetes, hypertension, arthritis, obesity, and depression, all of which brought her to Eden Valley Lifestyle Center for 3 weeks. Let's see how she did.
By the first weekend, I had two friends who came and they helped. My goal was to walk a mile. So over 3 hours, it took me, walk a little, sit down, walk a little, sit down. I made it a mile. I was so excited, so then I knew I could do it. And so the program at Eden Valley starts you early in the morning. I would get up at 4:45 by my choice, so I could have my shower, worship, go walk, and then come back in when we started the lemon juice and then the have worship and stuff like that. And I learned that I really liked that. It was very invigorating. I loved being at Eden Valley. The first day we were there, it was wonderful food. We had lunch. And the next day we started juicing. And well, the juicing was cool. But when I got to my second week of juicing, that's when I actually started bringing my toxins out. My blood sugar started coming down. It had been up at 170s, 180s. And it started coming down, and so they started decreasing my medicine. And originally I was on 3 medicines. Blood sugar, though, started crashing while I was there. And I remember one night, it was during a juicing time, and Travis said, here, if your crashes during the night, this is what I want you to do. I want you to eat this half of the green apple. And I was like, but I'm juicing. And he says, your sugar's going low. You're going to have to use the half of green apple. And if it crashes again during the night, use the other half. Well, I only ended up having to do one half of the apple, but it was very good. And I have to say that the juicing was probably the thing that helped my body changed the direction it was going. And it wasn't where we just juiced for 14 days. That wasn't it. We just did 2. And it was good, healthy food. And I would see the food that they were going to juice for the day. I remember one day I was sitting, I'd walked over to the Lifestyle Center and this gentleman was sitting in one of the go-karts and he was with his wife, Lisa Ann, and he said to me, he says, well, you're going to walk up that mountain. And I said, only if God gives me new hips and a new back. And he said, no, you will be walking. And that was probably about my 4th or 5th day there. By the second Sunday that I was, no, the third Sunday. It finished on a Thursday. The Sunday before that, I walked a mile and a half myself. And that was before breakfast. And my whole view of myself changed. While I was there, about a week and a half after I got there, my mother had emergency surgery. And the Lord had told me ahead of time something was going to happen to her, but I didn't know what. But I realized I felt so good by that time, I couldn't quit, because if I did, I would be killing myself. And I got my life back. I hadn't had that much energy. I couldn't do this much. It changed my perspective of where I was going. And by the end of it, I decided that my goal was in a year to come back and climb up the mountain that's behind the Lifestyle Center.
Awesome goal. It looks beautiful up there too. We're talking today with Dr. Davis, Vice President for Academic Affairs at Weimar Institute. I asked him what the problem would be if everyone pursued higher education and got a degree.
There is a serious problem. And one of the things that I like to oftentimes say is that if everything is a priority, nothing is a priority. So if you communize the workforce, if you will, in terms of everybody having a degree, then the value of that degree starts to diminish, such that, you know, 30 years ago, a high school degree was still something that was valued and could get you a job. And it wasn't too long after that, now you needed a bachelor's degree to get a job.
Right.
But now, there's the prevalence of bachelor's degrees is so far-reaching, here in the United States in particular, that now the master's degree is the real entry ticket. And how much longer is that going to be before everybody gets the master's degree? And it's so easy these days. And oftentimes I say this somewhat jokingly, but it's true. You pay your fee, you get your B, and then you get your degree.
And is that really true? Has that changed, the grading system or the quality required to get your master's or to get your bachelor's degree? Has it changed?
It has changed quite a bit. There are some institutions out there that there used to be, and still is in many of the good schools, a level of rigor that is required to make sure that you pass a particular course of instruction. A minimum amount of time in the classroom for didactic and then praxis. Well, there are institutions out there, online types of institutions, that will actually say, well, we understand that's what typically is required, but you know, if you can get it done in 2 or 3 weeks, which is typically a 15 to 17 week course, that's fine. They're more interested in the bottom line, that is the dollar. And so the more throughput that they can have, the better it is for their institution. And these organizations, they're accredited, but they're not accredited by regional accrediting agencies, bodies here within the United States, that actually are held in high esteem. And so we see this prevalence now of undergraduate, graduate, and postgraduate degrees that we didn't see 10, 20, 30 years ago. And so this is breaking, if not has broken, the higher education system.
So you mentioned earlier that the problem also starts back in primary, secondary school. So let's go right back to the beginning. What about early childhood education? How soon should children be going into the classroom?
You know, there's counsel that as Seventh-day Adventists in particular have, and that we don't want to put children in the classroom too soon. They need opportunities to develop motor skills, language skills, cognitive skills. And the sooner we put them into a classroom, for example, 3, 4 years old, we put them into preschool, and then they graduate into kindergarten and first, second, third, fourth grade, oftentimes they don't get an opportunity to develop physically, mentally, and even spiritually. And ideally, we want to put kids in the classroom around 8 or 9 years old. And they're going to do very well. People say, well, they're going to be behind. They're not going to be behind. They catch up very rapidly. It doesn't take long at all because they've developed other skills, social skills, those motor skills, cognitive skills, that oftentimes they're not learning in the classroom because it's very structured, very directed, and there's not an opportunity to explore. to kind of get an idea of what life is all about.
Now, at that age, an enriched environment or a very interactive mm-hmm. environment is important. So what if children don't have that at home or before they get to school?
Absolutely. The problems are plaguing. We've found that students or young children who have rich home environments tend to fare much better in terms of emotional and mental stability. This emotional intelligence and the maturation comes on at an earlier time. Although the frontal lobe takes many years to develop, we found that those who have that integrated home life that has the nurturing of both a mother and a father tend to fare much better in the school system than those who are not getting that, or perhaps are just placed off into somebody else's care because perhaps both parents are working. And I'm not saying that's necessarily bad.
And that is very common.
But it's very common, and that becomes problematic. We've also seen, here at Weimar in particular, that the students who have been homeschooled, although there is sometimes a lack of structure within a homeschool environment, not always, but sometimes it might be a little less than others, we found that in terms of the ability to reason and cognitive ability tends to be much better than an organized school system.
So what's the goal, say, of primary education? You're talking now about the analytical side, but primary education, what's the main goal at that level?
Well, the main goal for primary education is to prepare them to learn. We want to teach them how to think, how to reason, because what it's going to do is set the stage for later development and later learning. Because at the end of the day, even in a secondary and higher education setting, even though we're giving quite a bit of information, at the end of the day, we're looking still for those cognitive processes. We want those students to be able to think. We don't want to tell them what to think. We just want them to be able to think, and we want to give them skills on how to think and do it better. And that begins with the foundation in the primary years. And a lot of information is taken in during that time. There's, you know, the cognitive development and the just much of the development of a child between 7 and 12 years is very, very important. And so we want to make sure that
As educators,
we want to make sure that the children are receiving the best education. And frankly, the best education is in the home.
We'll find out why after the break. And now, food for thought. One of 9 things that contribute to the problem of dementia, they say, is to not finish high school. I have good news for those of you that never finished high school. It's actually never too late to pick up an education. And a powerful way to challenge our brains is the study of the Bible. It's filled with wisdom, instruction, philosophy, and the deep things of God. It will expand your mind and strengthen your intellect. You'll also find that it's relevant for everyday life. The world around us is changing faster than ever before, but the Bible, it stands the test of time. In here, there's a book that's specifically written for our generation, and that's the Book of Revelation. And while it's a challenge to read and understand, it comes with its own unique promise that those who read, hear, and live by what Revelation contains, it says that you will be blessed. To aid in understanding, there's a companion book called Daniel. It's like volume 1 and volume 2, Daniel and Revelation. You need one to understand the other. The comprehension of these 2 prophetic books will stretch you and grow you spiritually, intellectually, and it will prepare you for the days ahead and for eternity. When it comes to screen time for kids, the American Academy of Pediatrics recommends no exposure to technology until a child is 3. From 3 to 5 years of age, only 1 hour a day. And 6 to 18 years of age should be limited to 2 hours a day. Now, we all know that those recommendations are just not being followed in most households. In fact, the average under 5-year-old is watching 4.5 hours a day. That's 40% of their waking hours. What makes technology so harmful to children that they should not have any access under the age of 3? Well, kids' brains are still growing. In fact, between birth and the age of 2, an infant's brain triples in size and weight before it then slows down and stops growing at the age of 20. So it's all during this period that restrictions are placed. At birth, all the neurons are there. They're sitting there. But over the next 3 years, based on a child's experiences, those neurons begin to link up. And so from birth to 3, there's a 6-fold increase in the number of connections. And then going on, there's pruning based on the ongoing experience that they have with the world around them. Now, we know that too little stimulation early on, or sort of neglect, is very detrimental to emotional and brain development. You think of children in Eastern European orphanages. But what about too much stimulation? Kids actually can't discern real from fake, so those rapid screen changes in the media will actually precondition their brains to expect high levels of stimulation in real life. That is going to lead to an increase in attention deficit later on. And studies have shown that the more TV before the age of 3, the more attentional problems in school. There's a 10% increase for every hour of TV watching. Whereas if you cognitively stimulate your children, you give them tasks to do that engages their brain, or you take them to the zoo or to the museum, it actually reduces attentional problems by 30% for every hour you invest. Does the content of TV make a difference? It does. Educational TV doesn't appear to increase into attentional problems. Entertainment TV increases it by 60%. Violent TV more than doubles the risk. However, technology in general impairs executive function. That's frontal lobe function. It makes children more impulsive and they'll have less self-control or self-regulation. It impairs learning and reduces school readiness. And in fact, 1 in 3 children now is developmentally delayed at the time that they start school. Another problem is that 30% of our children are obese, and the risk is higher if they have a device in their bedroom. And 3 out of 4 kids do have a TV or some device in their bedroom. So they are more likely to have sleep deprivation that's linked to substance abuse, memory and learning difficulties, mood disorders, depression and obesity. Now, mental illness affects 1 in 6 of our young people, and the use of media has been implicated. Suicides are climbing, not necessarily because of bullying, which is actually falling. Violence is common in video games and on TV, and the more they watch, the more they express aggression that's in children and in youth. Now, many of us are relying on our cell phones for their memory to store that information rather than using our own memory. And that's been coined digital dementia, where the overuse of technology leads to a weakness in cognitive abilities. Now, that's bad enough for an aging brain, but in a developing brain, could there be serious long-term implications? You know, being indoors with a device means that a child is not outdoors in nature, where experiential learning can happen in 3 dimensions, where strenuous physical activity occurs and where imagination can flourish. For optimal hand-eye coordination, you need to be moving hands in 3 dimensions, not in 2 dimensions, across a screen. Outdoors is the best place for 3-dimensional experiential learning. You know, there's an addictive nature to gaming, television and social media. If you doubt that, just watch people when they get on their device. They are addicted. They're just glued to it. And if a developing brain is growing, pruning those connections and fine-tuning itself to the world around it, how does addictive behavior patterns shape those processes? Could the addiction be hardwired into the brain in such a way that there's no way out but by the grace of God? I want to appeal to parents and grandparents. I know it's tough, but try to follow the guidelines of no exposure for kids under 3, maximum of 1 hour a day of educational content in 3 to 5-year-olds, and only 2 hours of the same in older children. Let's instruct them in the way they should go, protecting them from the onslaught of information overload.
Studies in the 1950s showed Adventist men to have low levels of total cholesterol, an important factor in preventing heart disease. Nowadays, cholesterol can be divided into healthy and unhealthy fractions. A recent study again compared Adventist men to their non-Adventist neighbors and found their unhealthy, or LDL cholesterol, to be 9 points lower. A vegetarian diet and regular exercise were thought to make the difference. A lower LDL cholesterol is another ageless advantage.
Now it's time to answer your questions. Here's our first one. Sue asks, I've just been told I should not eat peanut butter because it contains mold. Well, unlike tree nuts, peanuts are grown in the ground, and so they are prone to getting mold, and that mold produces a toxin called aflatoxin, which is reported to be carcinogenic. However, the nut research shows that significant health benefits do come from peanuts. Also, one study looked at peanut consumption and found it was protective against cancer. So I think there's a bit of a quandary here. By the way, we've found aflatoxin in dairy, sunflower seeds, sunflower oil, and a few other foods. So basically, if we look for it, we might find it much more widespread. So I think go ahead and eat your peanut butter if you enjoy it. Next question, and this was a text message. I'm 85 and I'm trying to switch to a vegan diet. Well, bravo, no one is ever too old to benefit from switching to a plant-based diet. Keep watching the show and you'll see lots of tips of how to do it. And our third question from someone called and asked, how do I identify the healthiest grape juice? Is it best to have red, purple, or white juice? Well, the grape with the deepest color will have the most benefit. So that's dark red, or even better, the purple, often the Concord grape, is an excellent choice. Now, remember, you can contact us in a number of ways to send your question, Facebook, text, phone, or on the website. Like us on Facebook to become part of our Go Healthy for Good community and get some videos and things to see there. And now let's see what's in the store today. Farro is an ancient wheat that comes in several varieties, including einkorn and emmer. They are still enjoyed today in areas where they are thought to have originated. Einkorn in Georgia, Armenia, and Turkey, and emmer in the central Mediterranean. Wheat has changed. Early wild wheat had 14 chromosomes. Ancient varieties such as Durum wheat and Spalt have another 14, giving them 28 chromosomes. And most modern wheats have yet another 14 to make a total of 42 chromosomes. Farro originated in the Fertile Crescent, where it was found in the tombs of the pharaohs. It grows in poor soils and is naturally resistant to fungus. Due to its lower yield, it's less popular than modern varieties, but it has more fiber and protein, and its gluten is said to be weaker, making it more easily digested. Farro can help stimulate the immune system, lower cholesterol, and help with blood sugar levels. It's a favorite in Italian cuisine and is making a comeback here in America. If it is the whole grain variety, it needs to be soaked overnight before boiling for about 45 minutes. Pearled farro doesn't need soaking and cooks in just 30 minutes. Then you'll have yourself a nutty, wonderful grain that's great in soup, risotto, salad, or with fruit and yogurt for breakfast. Bon appetit. Today's guest is Dr. Alan Davis, Vice President of Academic Affairs at Weimar Institute. We concluded the last segment with the opinion that home is the best place to receive an education. I asked him why someone in his position would say that.
It's multifaceted. First off, the home is typically a secure place for a child. We would hope that it would be, at least. Moreover, they're used to their surroundings. So oftentimes the home is a great medium whereby to learn. The other thing too is, especially within a homeschool environment, that the parents are going to determine how the child eats, how much free time the child receives, play time, work time, and balanced properly, these lifestyle issues, these epigenetic issues, go a long way to help fostering the learning process.
So tell us, what foods might impair learning?
The ones that typically impair learning, right off the bat, refined sugars. A lot of our children today, they're fed so many things that are just full of sugars, whether they're refined sugar, high fructose corn syrup, various things that go contrary to what the body really needs. In fact, refined sugars, the science is now showing us, is more injurious than some of the actual drugs that people put in their bodies.
So what does sugar do to the brain or to the learning process that the student needs in the classroom?
Well, first of all, sugar suppresses the immune system. In addition to that, it affects the cells such that not enough oxygen is getting to the brain. And even though glucose is the primary fuel that the brain uses, what's happening is these refined sugars are breaking down the cells such that the hemoglobin, which carries the oxygen to the brain, is not as effective. Consequently, much of these children, they're in a mind fog because of these high doses of refined sugars.
So what's better food then? What's the best food for learning?
The best food for learning is a plant-based diet. Now, sugars are fine if they come in the form of, for example, a banana, mm-hmm. or an apple, or an orange. Because even though fructose, sucrose, glucose, they're still sugars, this has the fiber. And so the body takes it in differently and it breaks it down properly through proper mastication, digestion, and assimilation.
So it's going to last through the whole morning of class instead of just...
They're not going to get the spike such that they're very, for a moment, they seem to be very alert, but then within an hour, they go into the sugar low and they crash.
Now, thinking of this focus, caffeine is often touted as a drug that will increase focus, and the studies show it does.
It does.
But are there problems with caffeine in the classroom?
Yes. We can see the same issues as we would see with simple refined sugars. And a lot of times the caffeine that's being taken is combined with these simple sugars.
That's true.
So now they're getting a double hit, whether it's their Starbucks latte or whether it's some monster drink or Red Bull. When you combine these two, both of them are very addictive, and the brain leeches, towards that. But the problem is, yes, it is a stimulant for a short amount of time, but then it drops off, but then you need more to get the same level of stimulus that you had before, just like any other drug.
So you're saying what goes up comes down equally as much, and so you then trough,
and then
you need more to get you back
to normal.
And then it drops
even farther. Correct.
Yeah. Now, some schools are reducing classroom time, yet getting better academic performance. How do you explain that?
Well, too much time in the classroom, after a while, people begin to lose focus. And the attention span of youth, in particular, is not very long. And it doesn't get too much better as they get a little bit older. And part of that is the frontal lobe is still developing. And frontal lobe development lasts until about 25, and then there's some more maturation up to about the age of 30. So attention spans are oftentimes very low. What we found that is if we put somebody in the classroom, give them a certain amount of information, give them a break, 10, 15 minutes after about an hour of instruction, resume, do it again, after about 2 to 3 hours of learning, now they need a good size break. Go outside, do something different. The science has shown that when you spend a certain amount of time with cognitive issues, they begin to develop and move to the deeper recesses of the brain when you start using your hands, for example, gardening, mowing the lawn, washing dishes, going outside and playing. Things now begin to process, and they stay with you longer. They start moving from the short to the long-term memory.
Boosting memory by doing dishes and mowing lawns? Well, more from Dr. Davis after the break. And we're back. Deteriorating physical health and depression had really taken its toll on Barbara, till her sister gifted her a 3-week lifestyle program, which she loved. Now back home, she's had a small setback with a foot injury, though she's getting back on track. Let's see how she's doing.
I couldn't stand. I didn't do much. I mostly just was. And now I actually have a purpose. Now I actually have goals. Now I actually have reasons why I'm doing what I'm doing. This dress that I'm wearing, my sister bought for me 5 years ago. It's hung in my closet. I've never been able to wear it. Today is the first day I've worn it. Originally I lost almost 60 pounds, but right now I'm at about 50 pounds that I've lost. Someone said to me, when you're climbing a mountain, do you say, oh, I went up 25 feet, but just focus on those 5 feet you went back down? Or do you focus on the 20 feet you've already made it? And it changed my focus. And that's the big thing of what Eden Valley did, is it changed my focus. And it helped me to look at what things I was doing in my life that were making things not good for me. I am now off of my arthritis medicine. My blood pressure has been coming down so that some days I'm able to skip my blood pressure pill. My pulse has come way down. It had been up in the 80s and 90s. It's now sometimes in the 50s. I now have more energy. I now am able to do more. I did what Travis talked about, doing the gratitude book. I did that for quite some time, but I didn't keep it up. And one day I was at Sabbath school, and another lady who had been through the program with myself, there were 14 of us in the program at that time, and she said she'd been sending out thank you notes, and she'd noticed what a difference it had done for her and how she felt. And so I pick up my book and start writing in my gratitude book. And when I heard Travis speak today about doing the gratitude thing, I'm like, I have to be more faithful in this. I never filled out my evaluation of the program. I have it with me, and I am going to fill it out. But I don't care how much money it costs. You can't buy health. You can't buy the ability to believe in yourself again. You can't buy those things.
More precious than money. Today's guest, Dr. Alan Davis, believes that home is the best education facility a child can access. And what does he think about going outdoors periodically during a school day?
The fresh air stimulates the body. The sunshine, even if it's raining, it's still good to be outside. Studies in Europe have shown, both in Germany and in the Scandinavian countries, that students that go outside as a learning environment actually have better cognitive development, they have better motor skills, and they have better retention. And so we here at Weimar in particular have a model such that we don't keep the students in the classroom all day. We have a work education program. We break it up. And that has been very, very beneficial. And it takes learning to a new level. We found that the students do very well in terms of retention and then performance on examinations.
Earlier, you mentioned media. Mm-hmm. Now, media, presumably, do you use in the classroom? Do you not use in the classroom here? And how is it adversely impacting students?
We found that media, in particular, the overuse of screens, and today they're ubiquitous. iPhones, tablets, laptops, and they're being used for everything. They're actually shown to rewire the neurals, the pathways in the brain. And they're much like a drug. And every time, for example, and it could be anybody, but the young people, they're always on these things. Let's say they're looking at something on social media, Facebook, for example, and they've made a post, and now somebody has liked what they said, and they see that they, whatever they had to say was liked. That's like a shot of dopamine. And, oh, wow, somebody liked what I had to say. And so now they're looking for this. They make another post, and they're always going back to look to see what somebody else had to say. An affirmation, if you will, but it does give a sense of well-being. And we found that that is an addictive nature to the screens. The screens themselves, staring at these things hours upon hours in a day. Some of our programs here at Weimar that we have, when the clients come in, we actually take away their devices. And they
Isn't
have
that
to go
child
through withdrawal.
Abuse? Oh, they go through withdrawal?
They'll go through withdrawal.
Oh, my.
It's terrible.
Do you give them a withdrawal program?
No. Well, partially.
Yes, you do.
Now, as far as the classroom is concerned, we have to find a very healthy balance. Mm. Technology is a great asset, but it is an Achilles heel if we're not careful. So technology can be used to, for example, put visualizations up on the screen to help you better understand a concept.
Absolutely.
Now, what I do in my classroom, on the other hand, I don't allow the use of any electronic devices. Number one, they're getting distracted. I don't know if they're surfing the internet or not.
So if they're using their own,
that's right. I'm going to take that out of the way. And we've also found through research that when you take the hand, use tactile measures to write down notes, it sticks with you better than typing it in on a keyboard or punching it in on a tablet.
So better retention. And retention is a big part of the education system.
Retention is a big thing. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It really is. Because what's the point of learning anything if you don't remember it? Or if you don't know how to take it and apply it through proper synthesis?
Now, some people would argue they like to take notes on their computer. Mm-hmm. And I guess if you go back and reread those notes and really process them more slowly, as you would when you're writing them, perhaps that can make up some of that.
It potentially could. The jury's still out on that. One of the things that I've asked my students, if you're so inclined to do that, take notes by hand and then go put them on the screen. And that way you have them digitally. That's fine. And there would be good retention in that respect, too. I remember when I was going to college, I would take notes, and they were scribble, because, you know, you're trying to keep up with what the lecturer might be saying. And not everything was germane to what the lesson was, but you took the good notes. But then I would go back, and I would rewrite my notes more in longhand and actually look up the references that were perhaps cited. And now the retention is going deep. This is where real learning takes place.
So what educational principles can really optimize learning and life skills, do you think?
They're very simple, frankly. Have a good diet. Get plenty of rest.
We live in a sleep-deprived world.
We do. You know, ideally you want to get 7 to 8 hours every night. And make sure you get plenty of exercise. Because if you want to think right, you have to be right. A healthy mind cannot exist inside of an unhealthy body. It's simply not going to happen. So we need to stay physically strong to remain mentally strong. And now we've basically set the stage for ideal and optimal learning.
It's that simple?
It is that simple.
Education is so much more than intellectual development. Though it's important to learn how to analyze situations, think critically, and be discerning. A rounded education that includes practical work in the outdoors enhances brain development and memory. Emotional intelligence is the single most important factor to career success, and this is best taught in a stable, nurturing home at a young age. Invest much time with your children, especially between the ages of 7 and 12, to get them off to a good start. And be sure to teach them the joy of service. Don't forget that a wholesome diet, physical fitness, good sleep, and avoidance of social drugs are integral to personal development. Don't be afraid to place a limit on the use of media. That's all from me today. Thanks for joining us on Go Healthy for Good. I'll see you next time.